Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. No matter what the local weather, heavy rain has been the national headline recently as Hurricane Harvey left the Gulf Coast soaked and struggling, and now with Hurricane Irma charging toward Florida and Puerto Rico. And while New Hampshire has never seen rainfalls as heavy as those that came with Harvey, the Granite State is still no stranger to devastating downpours. But what have we learned from past flood events, and how much have we acted upon that hard-won knowledge? For example, updating our own personal disaster planning, or cities and towns improving their dams, pipes, roads, and other systems that come under stress from lots of sudden water. That's what we're asking today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guest for the hour is Perry Plummer, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the New Hampshire Department of Safety. And Perry, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
Also with us right now on the phone from Dartmouth College is Jonathan Winter, an assistant professor of geography at Dartmouth and co-author of a new study on precipitation in the Northeast region. And Jonathan, welcome. Thank you for taking time out.
Thanks, Laura.
So your study that you just came out with pretty recently found that in the mid-1990s, it seemed to suddenly get wetter in the Northeast. How much wetter?
That's right. So what we were looking at in particular is we were looking at our wettest days, our 1% wettest days. So you can think of that as something around 1 inch to 2 inches. That would qualify as one of those 1% wettest days. And what we found is that between 1901 and 1995, there was basically no change in those extreme precipitation events. And then basically after 1995, so starting in 1996, we've received 50% more extreme precipitation.
So all of a sudden, in 1996, you start to see a lot of these very wet days.
That's right. And if you look across the state, it's fairly consistent. And in fact, we did this for the entire Northeast, so basically West Virginia to Maine. And it's fairly consistent across even the entire Northeast, being that 50% increase. Annually.
So just a small question, Jonathan. Did the precipitation you measure include snow storms, ice storms? Because when people say precipitation, they usually think of rain, but I'm just wondering.
It does. So it's anything that we can catch in a gauge, in a precipitation gauge, and then that water would be melted. So if it's snow or ice, it would be melted and then measured.
So in this time period that you studied, and again, you've got two time periods here, sort of the beginning of the century up to 95 and then 96 and beyond when you see these spikes in extreme precipitation. Was this happening across the board, Jonathan, you know, all year long, or were there times in the year when it seemed to get especially soggy?
Yeah, so we saw increases in all of our seasons post-1995. But we saw the biggest jumps, so the biggest jumps in extreme precipitation in spring and fall, and they were both around 85%. So that's kind of leading us down our next line of work, which is to see exactly what events are causing this increase in extreme precipitation. And our leading suspects for the spring would be things like extratropical cyclones, which you can think of things like nor'easters. And then in the fall, we're fairly certain, and this has been studied by other researchers, and supports our hypothesis that it's tropical cyclones causing more extreme precipitation.
And we've always had hurricanes and tropical cyclones and nor'easters. So what are you thinking about why these are wetter than they were before?
So that's really still an outstanding scientific question, and that's the research we're trying to do now. Of course, we have natural variability in our climate system, so there's nothing to say that this couldn't just be a particularly wet stretch of climate where we're getting more tropical cyclones and also these nor'easters. But of course, there are also many reasons to think that climate change is contributing to this. So then the key becomes to try to tease apart which part of this is part of kind of natural variability or natural cycles in the climate, and which part of this is our own doing through anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions.
Anthropogenic means sort of man-made, like we did it.
That's right. Carbon dioxide emissions from our tailpipes, our electricity plants, et cetera.
You know, of this connection, and I know, Jonathan, you know there's been a lot written about this given the huge dump of rainfall that we saw from Harvey. I mean, it's just hard to wrap your heads around it. One person wrote of this climate connection for Harvey, you can't say climate change caused this storm. It just gave it its winning personality. In other words, made it more powerful than it would have been. What do you think about that, Jonathan?
I think that's an accurate representation. So scientists are always hesitant to attribute any one storm to climate change because it's very likely that Harvey could have existed without any man-made climate change, right? But what climate change does is it does a few things. It allows our atmosphere to hold more water, so when it rains, it pours. And the other thing it does is specifically in the case of hurricanes is it warms our ocean waters. And basically hurricanes draw their strength from warm ocean waters. So it was a sort of a confluence of events. And that's what we have down in the tropical Atlantic right now. It's very warm waters and prime conditions for hurricanes, which is why we saw Harvey and why we're seeing Irma.
That's interesting. So the warmer water not only increases the precipitation once the storm hits land, but it makes it more powerful. It gives it steroids, so to speak.
That's right. That's right. And it allows it to basically, the warmer air, you can think of it as a bucket. So basically the air can hold more water so that when it gets over land, it can dump that water on Houston. And it's the same thing up here. Our warmer air with these nor'easters or the tropical cyclones that do make it up to us, or even, you know, frontal systems or little convective events that we have that cause extreme precipitation, you can have more water basically being held in the atmosphere. So when the precipitation processes start and you start dumping that bucket, it's a bigger bucket that gets dumped on any one area.
You know, climate scientists for many years now have been predicting a wetter future for the Granite State. And then, you know, some people say, Jonathan, gee, last year we had a horrible drought. It took us a long time to get out of that. So I just wonder how you piece that together.
So you can think of it as you can think of it as a kind of a background. It's probably easiest to think of it in terms of temperature. So you have cold winters, you have warm winters, and overall you have this kind of slow creep of increasing temperatures. And you kind of put that on top of the cold winters and the warm winters. So we will have droughts in the future. And yes, we will have wet times in the future, but overall the signal is becoming wetter. And there are also reasons to think that climate change might hit us in both areas. So it might cause our extreme precipitation events to become worse and our droughts to become worse.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Because while that air can hold more water and dump it on us, it can also hold more water and pass right over us. And also warmer temperatures can drive more evaporation from the land surface. So basically what dries out our soils, you can get more of that. So in our typically dry periods, we can actually have climate change making that worse, making it more dry.
So overall, though, Jonathan, what I'm understanding from you is a wetter future for New Hampshire.
Yes, a wetter future for New Hampshire, more precipitation.
And what parts of the state do you think, Jonathan, would be most vulnerable in this wetter future?
So when you start to talk vulnerability, you have to think about where how this precipitation ends up basically harming people. So you think of people in river valleys, floodplains, low-lying communities next to lakes. And I guess I would be most particularly concerned about coastal communities because they're going to have to be dealing with both increased extreme precipitation, and they in their baseline, they actually get more extreme precipitation than we do inland. And then they'll also have to deal with sea level rise, which is something that we haven't touched on and not tied to precipitation, but still tied with global climate change and something that can compound and basically cause flooding in and of itself.
Okay, Jonathan, good to talk to you. We'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Laura.
That's Jonathan Winter, assistant professor of geography at Dartmouth College, co-author of a recent study on extreme precipitation in the Northeast. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at how well-prepared New Hampshire might be for extreme weather events. Again, we've seen plenty of these in the past decade or so, but still, there are lessons to be learned and preparations to make for the next event. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Perry Plummer, so leaving off with Jonathan there, this is right in your area as Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. What parts of the state do you see as most vulnerable in preparation for this wetter future that Jonathan
described?
Well,
certainly we look at an all-hazards approach when we do our planning because we don't know what's going to come next. We don't know if it's going to be a storm. We don't know if it's going to be a human-caused disaster or a natural disaster. So we do an all-hazards planning approach. So, you know, we look at the state from an all-hazards approach and look at every part of the state, what they're vulnerable for, and how to prepare for that. With that being said, certainly Jonathan hit it right, you know, the seacoast is a challenge. I mean, they got storm surge from storm. They're going to have rains, and then they have evacuation routes that are challenging as well. But, you know, if you look at a couple of years ago, we had flash flooding on Slayton Hill in Lebanon. That was not on a river, and people got flooded out because it was a flash flood. So it's not as simple as saying, I live next to the river, I'm going to get flooded, and I live on a hill, I'm not going to get flooded. When you drop the amount of rain that was dropped on Harvey, certainly, but even you know, 6 or 8 inches of rain, there's going to be flooding flooding normally doesn't occur because our infrastructure is not set up to carry that amount of water. And, you know, obviously it's amount of rain and rainfall rates, but it's also melting, it's winds, it's all those hazards. So, you know, certainly I can't say that if you live in this part of our state, you don't have to worry about preparedness and emergency preparedness. Certainly we deal every day with, you know, mitigation. How do we make it so it doesn't happen to us? And certainly with storms, that's difficult, but we can improve our infrastructure. So if we get certain amounts of rain, then it doesn't affect our population. And then we get into, you know, preparation. There's two types of preparation. There's personal preparation and there's government preparation, local, state, and federal preparation. So we have to, or preparedness. So we have to look at that. And then obviously, you know, we have to prepare for the response should something happen for any type of hazard throughout our state and set those response systems in place. And then some of the greatest challenges is the recovery. I mean, certainly the response phase, whether it be in a hurricane like Harvey or any other event, the response phase is the one that you see on TV a lot. And it's, you know, it's certainly important because we're making rescues and those type of things. But the recovery stage takes a long time. We're just closing out one of our disaster grants on a project that happened in Irene in 2011. Hurricane/Tropical Storm Irene was 2011, was $22 million disaster for us in FEMA, and dropped 7 inches of rain. We're just taking care of one of those projects right now. So that recovery
takes a long time.
We have about 9 open disasters right now that we're dealing with recovery.
So I appreciate what you're saying that, you know, when I ask you what parts of the state might be most vulnerable, you're saying everybody's vulnerable because of the nature of extreme precipitation. Boom, all at once. In preparation for the show today, I was thinking, well, I live at the top of a hill and I don't live near the river, so I'm good. But you're telling me no.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that, you know, we'll talk a second about, you know, individual preparedness and what people can do. But one of the things you can do is buy flood insurance. The good news is if you live on top of a hill and you have very little chance of flooding, it's not very expensive. The bad news is most people don't think about it, so they don't get it because it's not required by your mortgage. But then I remember walking the Slayton Hill disaster with Senator Shaheen, and she says, how many of these people had flood insurance? And the answer was none, because they live on a hill. Why would you buy flood insurance? But you can be flooded. So that is a piece of the individual preparedness, should you be able to afford that. But, yeah, and because we take an all-hazards approach, you know, our response framework and how we plan and drill and exercise on a regular basis has to be an all-hazards approach, because we don't know, are we going to get a hurricane today? Are we going to get a tornado tomorrow? Are we going to get a terrorist attack, a month from now? And so our framework has to be universal. So a lot of the training we do is for all hazards, and it makes it so it's a good bang for the buck. Every month we get all our state partners together in our Emergency Operations Center and train. And if we just train for hurricanes, what if it's a tornado? Are we missing the boat? Or what if it's a human-caused disaster? Are we missing the boat? So that framework is, we try to use that universal framework, and that's done nationally through national incident management systems. So we can't say, if you live in this part of the area, you're not vulnerable, because you're vulnerable to something.
Yeah, so you try and look at it, again, as you described, this all-hazards approach, just be ready for anything. Still, in terms of water, big rainstorms, major floods, Perry, it seems like in the mid-2000s especially, New Hampshire saw a lot of these. What stands out in your mind that had large impacts on the state and that we learned from?
Yeah, certainly. We've learned a lot locally. You know, we've had Hurricane Sandy in 2012. We had Hurricane Irene in 2011. We had the Hurricane Floyd in 99. But we had some really big other storms. You know, when you look at the Mother's Day floods of 2006, that was $25 million. That was 10 to 20 inches of rain. So we've had big rainfalls in our state. With that, obviously, that's one of our biggest challenges. No power or flooding are the things that we deal with most of all, because people aren't happy if they're standing waist deep in water,
yeah,
or they don't have power. So we deal with that on a regular basis. Sometimes it's just a pocket of flooded area, and we have to deal with those communities and residents, and sometimes it's widespread. But certainly, we have to look at our infrastructure. How do we rebuild our infrastructure to handle some of that? We know it's going to happen. We know, we just heard from Jonathan, we know that more water is coming. We're going to get these type of rainstorms. Obviously, I don't think we'll get a Harvey in New Hampshire, but we are going to get 10 and 15 inches of rain, and that's going to challenge our infrastructure. We need to rebuild our infrastructure to protect our residents, protect our public critical infrastructure, and then be the individual preparedness so we can make sure that our lives aren't affected by it.
When you say infrastructure, what types of infrastructure you're talking about, Perry?
Well, everything from roads and bridges to our electrical grid and that infrastructure, to right down to all the things that provide service, our wastewater treatment plants, our water treatment plants for drinking water. All those types of critical services that we need, the critical lifeline services, are really important. And it does come down to, keeping our power grid up, being able to traverse and get fuel, get food, get those things that you need. So it's that whole public infrastructure. And then obviously it's, individual homes and rescues and how do we make it so we're not losing lives in some of these events.
Well, and speaking of drinking water, that's one of the, there's so many headlines coming out of the Houston area, but that's one of them, that a lot of folks are either boiling or having to buy their drinking water because you just sort of forget, but it's not safe.
It doesn't take a lot to contaminate a lot of water because, when you get widespread flooding, you're getting everything from fertilizers and lawns leaching out and washing into our waterways to petroleum products, to all the stuff that's around us. If you just drive down the road and look at, eye level and see all the different things that if that was a flooded area, would leach into our water. So drinking water is a big concern during flooding events.
All right. Well, since we're talking about infrastructure, coming up, we'll talk to Jim Gallagher, chief engineer of the Dam Bureau for the state. We'll find out how strong our dams are. All of that, plus your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Thank you.
I'm Virginia Prescott, here to tell you that after 8-plus years, word of mouth is ending its run as a weekday show. But I am thrilled to announce a revamped, retooled, and relaunched Word of Mouth weekend show beginning September 2nd. From now on, we are going local, answering your questions about the state and exploring the culture, history, and geography of the place we call home. Listen in to the new Word of Mouth, Saturdays at 11, right after Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, no matter what the local forecast is, heavy rain is on everyone's minds, given the deluge that Houston residents are still struggling with. So this hour, we're asking, how well prepared is New Hampshire for major rains and floods? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at nhprexchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. My guest for the hour, Perry Plummer, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the New Hampshire Department of Safety. And joining us now on the phone is Jim Gallagher, Chief Engineer of the Dam Bureau for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Jim Gallagher, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks, Laura. Good to talk to you again. And hello, Director. How are you?
Good, Jim. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
So from what I understand, Jim, New Hampshire has roughly 2,500 dams. What do we know about their condition? Nobody wants a dam to break.
No, that's right, Laura. You know, in areas, it's about a little over 2,600 dams. Fortunately, in New Hampshire, because we are so rural, most of the state, three-quarters of those dams are what we call non-hazardous dams. And if they were to fail, it could not cause any problem downstream at all. But we do have about 146 high-hazard dams, and those dams, if they were to fail, would cause loss of life. They would inundate homes and cause a lot of damage like you see in there in Houston. A number of those were built many years ago before modern design standards for dam safety. And many of them can't pass. When I say many of them, I guess it's probably on the order of about a third of them now, can't pass what we call a design flood for a high-hazard dam. And in New Hampshire, that's 2.5 times a 100-year flood. And I say safely pass them. The spillway capacity, when a dam overflows, ideally it's confined to the spillway, the concrete spillway on the top of the dam.
So, Jim, hang on. I'm going to jump in and just unpack a little bit of this for folks who aren't as familiar with how dams work. So a high-hazard dam sounds really bad. So what does that mean specifically?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the condition of the dam, or it has all to do with what's downstream of the dam. So a brand-new dam that is built perfectly, if there is homes or businesses, or there could be a loss of life if the dam were to fail. It's called a high-hazard dam.
I see. So the high-hazard dam is where there's just a lot of people living downstream, even if the dam is, you know, brand spanking new and has no flaws.
Exactly right. And then even these non-menace dams that I spoke about, if there's nothing downstream now but a house was to be built in the potentially inundated area, that non-menace dam automatically becomes a high-hazard dam. And that's occurred to some extent here in New Hampshire with downstream development.
So how good a shape are they in, though? I mean, from what I understand, a lot of them are old. I mean, are they cracking? Do they have holes? I mean, this has been a problem in past flood eras.
Well, in New Hampshire, we have a pretty rigorous inspection program. And we keep after the dam owners to keep their dams in good shape. But the about 15% of the dams are what we call in poor condition. And that doesn't have to do so much with issues that you mentioned, cracking or spall concrete. It really has to do with this flood capacity issue. They were designed many years ago based on the knowledge of hydrology at the time, and they can't pass what we now call the design flood. As I was mentioning before, for high-hazard dams, that's 2.5 times the 100-year flood. It's not the Noah's Ark flood. It's not the size of the flood that Houston's been getting. It's something a little bit less than that, but something still rare. It's on the order of a 1 in 500-year flood. And what happens on these dams is the outlet works, the spillways, only have so much capacity, and when these floods exceed that capacity, the water comes over the abutments of the dam, and it could erode those abutments and cause those dams to fail.
So I see what you're saying. So these dams are, you know, no knock against how they were built, but they were built under an earlier set of assumptions that no longer fit given the climate predictions. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. And, you know, in New Hampshire and in New England here, these dams were the source of power. So many in the 1800s, and so many dams date back that long. And not only was there a lack of understanding about hydrology back then, but even from, say, the 1980s to now, there's been increases in what the design flood actually is. In other words, a 100-year flood back in the 1980s was considered about a flood from 6 inches of rainfall in New Hampshire. Now, based on the additional flooding that we have gotten, those estimates now have increased. And so a 100-year flood now is a little over 7 inches of rain. And that makes a big difference when it comes to spillway capacity.
You mentioned earlier that most dams in the state, Jim, are privately owned. What does that mean in terms of inspections and quality?
Well, it is a challenge. So, for three-quarters of these dams are privately owned. A lot of those dam owners don't have the resources to take care of their dams. And we find this to be a real struggle, particularly if they have to do major modifications. And what's been done in the past is these private owners often don't have the benefit of the dam. You know, it's the folks who live along the shoreline get the benefit of the dam. And so when these dams require major repair, oftentimes the dam owner has to go to the shoreline residents and work out a deal for funding the repairs of those dams. But it's a real challenge. Unlike other infrastructure, which is publicly owned and has a revenue source to pay for the repairs, a lot of these privately owned dams do not have a revenue source. Fortunately, there are very few high hazard dams that are owned by private entities, and there are only very few. I think there's four dams which we would call poor because they can't pass the design flood. So it's not really a real problem. Yeah, actually, the state of New Hampshire is the biggest dam owner in the state, and we have 17 dams in our inventory of 278 that are high hazard and can't pass the design storm.
So what do you do about that?
Well, we've been getting funding from the legislature for the in the capital appropriations from the legislature for the past four bienniums to address this issue, and we've got a plan to correct this issue on eight dams over the next 6 years. We're going to be addressing three in this current biennium, another three in the next biennium, and two in the biennium after that.
So, Jim, as you look at this, you know, disaster, which seems almost too small a word. I mean, it's just what's going on in Houston and the surrounding area. And dams are certainly part of that story. What do you, as sort of the chief engineer of the Dam Bureau, what does this make you think about as a dam expert?
Well, it does. We do worry because we can get a rainfall event like they had in Houston. In Houston, they places get about 40 inches of rain. Other places get almost 50 inches of rain over a period of time. Here, theoretically, our worst storm is 28 to 36 inches of rain over a 72-hour period. Certainly, that would cause tremendous flooding in New Hampshire. In the 2005 and the 2006 floods, in the 2007 floods, we only had, in 2005, about 10 inches in southwestern New Hampshire, and that caused certainly a lot of damage and loss of life. It's those events that we do worry about. And because these dams don't have necessarily the discharge capacity, operations of these dams in advance of a flood is real important, and we've been able to do that on these state-owned dams in advance of some of these, in advance of Hurricane Irene, in advance of the Tropical Storm Sandy. We're able to do operations to help mitigate the problem that we have with spillway discharge capacity. And then on the private side, we also, during these events, also reach out to those private dam owners.
Keep an eye on what's going on.
Urging them to do the same sort of operations that
we
do. And we have to coordinate that because there's so many dams in the state, the 2,600 dams. If you release water from a dam upstream, it's going to go to that dam downstream. So all that has to be coordinated all the way out to the ocean.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, nice to talk to you again.
That's Jim Gallagher, Chief Engineer of the Dam Bureau of the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. You can join us today in the exchange as we look at how well-prepared New Hampshire is for major rains, major floods. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Perry Plummer, you know, just more broadly, pulling back from looking specifically at dams, but looking at infrastructure more broadly, how well would you say New Hampshire's infrastructure is set up for these floods? You know, looking at dams and culverts and pipes and roads. I mean, if you had to give it a grade.
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge, and there's been an infrastructure grading system out there. And, you know, most of the infrastructure in New Hampshire is in the B and C level. That, you know, obviously it's road dependent, it's bridge dependent, some are owned by local communities, some are owned by state. But certainly it's something that we're all aware of and we're looking at and with FEMA. And when we rebuild from disaster funds, now FEMA does let you upsize certain culverts and make certain arrangements. So that we're better prepared. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're all working through this, and it's a balance between dollars and preparedness and the amount of work that you can get done in a work season. So it's really a balance. But I can tell you that we're trying to strike this balance. You know, Governor Sununu has been involved in these discussions of preparedness, mitigation, response, and recovery since before he got into office. He does spend time with emergency management. We talk often. He's aware of every storm that comes through. So, you know, he is aware of these things and is working very hard to make sure that we are prepared. The one thing that we do want to say, though, is individual preparedness for what can you do? How can you make a difference? First is if you can buy flood insurance, certainly do that. That makes that recovery so much easier because FEMA does not make you whole. They get you back on your feet. There's a big gap between whole and back on your feet. With that being said, we ask all of our residents to be prepared for anything for 72 hours. So that means you need food, water, medications, pet food, all those things for 72 hours because in New Hampshire, we have a pretty good response system. You know, especially in the cities, you pick up the phone and in 3 or 4 minutes, fire department there, police department's there. That doesn't happen in a large storm. You're going to have to be self-sufficient for a while. And the longer you can be self-sufficient as a resident, then those emergency crews can handle the real emergencies and cut down on the number of rescues that have to happen. So 72 hours. Think about what you'll need for 72 hours. Think about a reunification plan. How do I notify my relatives that I'm okay? You know, where can I evacuate to? Set these things up beforehand. Put together an emergency kit. Create a practice plan for your family of what you would do and how you'd be reunited. Fill out emergency contact cards. But most importantly, stay informed. If you go to readynh.gov, which is the state's emergency preparedness website, there's a whole host of tips and information about preparedness. And you can also sign up for New Hampshire Alerts, which is a free emergency alerts notification system. So you'll know what's happening. You'll get notified.
Sometimes that's hard, though, when the power's out. I remember the ice storm of 08.
No question.
You know, people were saying, go to the website and find out more. And that's, people were saying, I don't
right.
have it, a website.
Those old AM radios with batteries, get those. But get an extra power charger for your cell phone. Cell phones are so important. And generators, obviously, are great. But readynh.gov, if you don't do anything else, go to readynh.gov and look at that website. And you know, we all have to take responsibility to be prepared because in something like Houston or in something like Irene or even in this disaster that we just had in Grafton County, emergency crews are going to be stretched.
Well, and speaking of flash floods, which you mentioned a couple minutes ago, Perry, the National Weather Service in Gray, Maine, has issued a flash flood watch for portions of Maine and New Hampshire, including in New Hampshire, Belknap, Cheshire, Eastern Hillsborough, Interior Rockingham, Merrimack, Northern Carroll, Southern Carroll, Southern Grafton, Stratford, Sullivan, and Western and Central Hillsborough counties. That's from noon today through Thursday morning. So I just wanted to let folks know about that. Let's go to our listeners, and Sherry is first in Londonderry. Hi, Sherry. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is this. Assuming I have power to run the pump, is my well water safe to drink if there is some sort of a disaster? My well is, I can't remember the exact footage, but it's between 500 and 700 feet down. And I was just wondering if that water was okay.
I see what you're saying. Yes, we talked earlier about stuff washing off into a reservoir, a public water system. Can you talk about private wells, Perry?
Well, it's a very good question, and the answer is maybe. But what I would say is, in most minor flooding incidents, your well would be fine. But certainly, the Department of Environmental Services does a great job getting information out there. That's information that we would push out at the time of an incident of what areas that might be of concern, and provide that information on a regular basis. But certainly, I would try to stay informed and listen. But chances are your well water on a minor flooding event would be fine. But when in doubt, I think you need to stay tuned and ask those questions at that time, because they might be or they may not be.
Okay. Well, Sherry, thank you for the question. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Fred who says, how are Seabrook Station and the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard situated to survive storm surges and windstorms greater than what was imagined decades ago? Thank you for the question, Fred. And Perry, what can you tell us?
Well, certainly that I understand the question. I understand the concern. With that said, those two locations are some of the most prepared locations there are in our state, and then right over the border in Maine. And we help handle the offsite response plan for Seabrook Station, and we have those conversations on a regular basis. The National Regulatory Commission and FEMA have graded exercise. They're looking at those standards, and they're always looking at the preparedness aspect. And certainly, you know, we test that. We have graded exercises on a regular basis based on storms and or other hazards that may hit or disasters that may hit. But those are looked at on a regular basis. So right now we feel pretty confident that they're pretty prepared. With that being said, I don't think anybody anticipated Harvey, and I think that's going to make us go back to the drawing boards and look at a lot of our critical infrastructure to say, are we prepared at what level? With that being said, I think that Jonathan mentioned that warm water drives some of that stuff, so the chances of a Harvey in the Northeast is very, very remote, but certainly we can have challenging storms.
Well, it's interesting. You said, you know, we're all kind of looking at Harvey and what we might see in terms of our own vulnerabilities and preparations. You've been quoted, Perry, in the Union Leader as saying that Hurricane Katrina in 2005 was a, quote, industry-changing event. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, certainly. I think that anybody that watches the news knows that the response, the preparation or the preparedness and response to, and maybe even some of the recovery efforts in Katrina was not what we as a nation would be as proud as if we could have. So I know that FEMA and emergency management agencies at the state and local level all looked at those after action reports and tried to implement a lot of things that so we wouldn't have another Katrina. And if you look at the response of Harvey from, and it's really early in the response to really give any grades, but they've done a pretty good job based on the news reports of what they're doing and the stuff that we're getting through our industry. So it changed how we look at flooding. It changed how we move people. It changed notifications. It changed our evacuation thought processes of when we evacuate, when we don't evacuate. You know, we've got plans in place that we have evacuation plans. We have shelter plans. We have commodity plans that we never had in the past. We have plans. How do we distribute commodities to the communities, and how do the communities distribute those commodities out to their residents? Those commodities could be generators, they could be food, they could be water. We have those plans in place that we did not have pre-Katrina. So, you know, 9/11 and Katrina both changed our industry as we look at it. Now, I think, Harvey, you'll be another industry-changing event. We're going to look at everything from our preparedness to our response and our recovery and say, how do we do it better? How do we protect our citizens better? And how do we spend our money better?
Okay. Well, I know you've got somewhere else you got to go. It's a busy time for you, Perry. I really appreciate you coming in. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, we'll find out about more culverts and how prepared they might be for extreme rain, other precipitation events, and we'll keep taking your calls, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, preparing for heavy rains. How well set up are New Hampshire communities for major precipitation? That's what we're looking at. We welcome your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. We've been speaking with a number of people who look at all aspects of preparedness, of response to major rain events. With us now on the phone is Fred McNeil. He's chief engineer at the Environmental Protection Division in Manchester, where he focuses on wastewater. And Fred, welcome back. Great to have you.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to share industry story with you and our listeners.
Well, in terms of responsibility, Fred, there you are in Manchester. Who's responsible for the infrastructure that you look at? Is it the state? Is it the local government? What's the sort of division of responsibility there?
It's the local government, Laura. The City of Manchester, through the Department of Public Works, owns, operates, and maintains over 1,000 miles of pipes underneath our city. And that's between water, wastewater, and stormwater.
1,000 miles of pipes, and just describe that a little bit for us. Fred, it sounds kind of dramatic. I can picture it running under the city. What do those pipes do? How visible are they?
Well, unfortunately, they're invisible to the public. And so we're really faced with our major problem, Laura, is aging and failing infrastructure. Out of that 1,000 miles of pipe, about 250 miles is over 100 years old. And when that pipe was installed 100 years ago, it wasn't installed for today's population. It wasn't installed for today's impervious area, and it certainly wasn't installed for today's climate change. So that infrastructure that's in the ground has reached the end of its useful life. So we're faced with two problems. Number one, aging and failing infrastructure that we need to replace, and two, undersized infrastructure that wasn't designed for today's population and storms.
Wasn't designed for today's population and storms. Talk a little bit more, if you could please, Fred, about today's storms, the heavier rainfall that we've seen, flash flooding, sudden events, and how that affects the infrastructure underneath the city of Manchester and probably a lot of cities.
Well, most of the cities are similar to us. And I had a baptism of fire because the Mother's Day flood was, I was on the job for 1 month, and I quickly learned how quickly our infrastructure can be overwhelmed as it was on the Mother's Day flood. What we're doing to address this is as we move forward and replace our infrastructure, we're increasing the size of it. As people have mentioned, things are designed in the engineering world on reoccurring events, 25-year storm, 50-year storm, 100-year storm. Well, we've increased the size of all our pipes from a normal 25-year design standard to a 50-year design standard. So as we move forward, we are trying to address the change in climate and the increased extreme weather events.
So the pipes have to be bigger.
Well, there's no question about that. And then the pipes that we have now aren't big enough. And it's kind of funny because hearing all the reports from Houston, one of the first things that they noticed that indicated the flooding was going to occur was all the toilets started to back up. And as we said before, the contaminants during flooding can be a serious issue. And let me expand on a couple items that were mentioned earlier. Both water treatment plants and wastewater plants. Generally, they're located next to a water source. So here in Manchester, we have a beautiful water treatment plant next to Lake Massabesic. That is fed by a huge watershed. So if extreme rain event could happen, that could be put into jeopardy. Similarly, the wastewater plant, as with most wastewater plants, are located near a river to discharge the effluent. Same problem here during the Mother's Day event. The river rose so much it actually entered our plant. And so this critical infrastructure, especially vulnerable, drinking water and wastewater during these extreme weather events.
I want to ask you a broader question before we get back into some of the specifics. And I got a couple specific questions from our listeners about runoff and culverts and so forth. But you and our other guests, Fred, have talked about 50-year maps or flood maps or planning for 100-year storms or 500-year storms or 200-year storms. It seems like it's almost reached the point where we shouldn't bother using these numbers because they keep getting outdated. Do you know what I'm saying? What do you think?
Well, the engineering industry and culture is very conservative by nature. And so we need some sort of standard to follow. And that's been the design standard for centuries, literally. And I do not see that changing.
But the standard keeps getting revised, you know?
Well, and standards do get revised, and they get updated as they should be. And so, you know, my recommendation would be to keep these standards because you need something to design by. And again, as an industry, again, being a conservative industry, it takes years and years to revise a standard. But I would say keep those standards, and I would urge communities to look in the future. What I always share with our staff here is our legacy. I want people to look back in 100 years and say these people knew what they were doing 100 years ago because, again, they identified a problem and took action.
Here's an email from Barbara in Aetna who says, I'm wondering if it makes sense to ever install a larger culvert since downstream storm damage gets enlarged with increased upstream flow. She says, shouldn't we be looking for better ways to infiltrate and slow that water? Does municipal and state policy need rethinking? Barbara, great questions. Thank you. And what do you think, Fred?
Well, there is a big push for that. It's called green infrastructure. And it's in the form of many things. It can be rain gardens. It can be impervious pavement. It can be plantings. And EPA has put a great emphasis on green infrastructure in a lot of communities. Philadelphia has a $1 billion program going with it. But to be perfectly frank, I'm not a fan of green infrastructure because it is not robust enough to take this large amount of impervious area in these large communities. When a rain event happens, we get millions of gallons of water. It's very difficult to treat that through impervious pavement or rain gardens or plantings. You need robust infrastructure. When I say robust infrastructure, I'm talking about pipes, you know, 6 feet in diameter, box culverts, you know, 10 feet by 10 feet. That's what we need to convey the water that's being generated through this climate change.
And again, for those who aren't as up on it as you, pervious, impermeable, just remind us what we're talking about here, Fred.
Okay, because there's been a push on impervious means that water cannot penetrate. So a roof is impervious. Roadways are generally impervious.
Driveways, parking lots, water just rushes off.
And so all that water has to run off somewhere. And so what they've tried to do is bring Mother Nature back in the equation and have this water, as it used to do, percolate down into the ground. So they've come up with pavements that instead of water running off or actually run down through it.
Gets soaked up, kind of like dirt or grass would do.
That is correct. But unfortunately, that's not really, in my opinion, appropriate application for New England, because we have a freeze-thaw cycle, and we also have winter plowing. And that type of pavement isn't robust enough to stand up to winter plowing. And plus, if you sand the road, that will clog up that impervious pavement.
So some questions about the pervious pavement, the pavement that acts like the ground. What about, though, here's an email from Sam who says, it seems like one of the most important infrastructure changes is an increase in permeable surfaces in urban areas. So sidewalks, driveways, and other hard surfaces, Sam says, can now be constructed with material that will allow stormwater to go through rather than run off. Sam says there are a lot of other examples, sunken medians in parking lots, rain gardens, tree box filters. UNH has a stormwater center, he says, that I got a tour of a few years back, and they're doing some great research there. More of this needs to be implemented in designs in cities. Setting aside the debate over pervious pavement, again, pavement that acts more like ground, what about the other efforts that folks are talking about? Again, you know, more trees, rain gardens, and so forth.
And we do implement them, Laura, and as I said, EPA has been very aggressive in pushing these agendas. But frankly, we just don't have the green space. In Manchester or in Concord, you walk around downtown area and show me an area that you could put a basin 100 feet by 200 feet that you could put planting in to absorb this water. You know, again, that footprint just isn't there for the infrastructure that's required to convey all of this stormwater.
Getting back to the culverts, I know this has been a problem in past flood events, Fred, especially in Alsted. How do you calculate how big a culvert needs to be? Again, a culvert is sort of a pipe that like runs under a road, right? It transports the water under the road so that it doesn't crack up the road.
That is correct. And in general terms, what you have to do is delineate a catchment area. And that means the area of earth or ground that runoff will be generated from into this culvert. So it could be 1 acre, it could be 40 acres. And then this is when the rain event comes in. So now you have this square area delineated, the catchment area, and then you do the storm event. So if it's a 20-year storm event or a 40-year storm event, and there's a volume of rain associated with that. And so now you have the volume of rain and you have the catchment area, and you do a calculation, and then you put a safety factor into it.
And how hard is it to make calculations like that these days, Fred, given, again, that we keep seeing these, you know, 100-year floods every couple of years?
Well, that is our challenge for the industry. And the mathematic exercise is very easy, calculating the area of the catchment area. And as I said, now all of our drainage, the city of Manchester is using a 50-year storm event. And that's how we proceed. And I really don't foresee that changing in the industry. But we've discussed a few times that reoccurring event, be it 20, 50, 100 years, is a moving target.
One of the things that people also worry about when it comes to roads is that if there is too much water, unseen water, or a problem with the pipes or the culverts underneath the road, all of a sudden a sinkhole develops. It's a very scary prospect for folks. How much planning do you make in terms of that possibility?
Well, you know, a lot of those are also from broken utilities underground.
Ah.
And generally water mains, because they're under pressure and generally fairly high pressure. And so, again, if there's a failure there, that will create a sinkhole. But you're also correct. If you remember, there was a large sinkhole in 93 2 years ago just in Concord on the northbound lane, and that was from a brick culvert. And so there's no way, really, to prevent that. A lot of these things, the one in Concord actually, was another 100-year-old culvert. So, again, this 100-year-old infrastructure has reached the end of its useful life. It could last another 2 years, it could last another 20 years, or it could last two more days.
So, 100-year infrastructure, and as you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation, not really prepared for today's population density and for the strength of the storms that we're seeing. Do communities like Manchester have the funding to update this 100-year infrastructure?
Well, no, we do not have sufficient funding to update it all. And no, we do not have the resources to do it. You know, we struggle to replace and repair 1 or 2 miles of sewer a year because this existing infrastructure, in my case, the wastewater, that's always the deepest pipe in the street. So whenever we go to repair this, we have water on top of us, you know, underneath the street, you have several utilities. You generally have water, you generally have gas, you have drainage, and then a lot of times you have fiber optics. So it's very time-consuming for us to go in, go under all these utilities, and replace our pipes. So what we've been doing a lot of is lining these pipes to increase, instead of another 100 years, another 40 or 50 years. And the city of Manchester does have a formal program, both on the water side and the wastewater side, to prolong the life of these pipes. Both by lining. And so we are moving forward. But when you have a 250 miles of pipe over 100 years old and you're doing 2 or 3 or 4 miles a year, you're never going to catch up.
I have two Facebook comments here, Fred. Again, back to our earlier conversation about green infrastructure and the impact of pervious pavement and other surfaces where water just rushes off really quickly. Lara says on Facebook, what about flooding caused by development? I live in Hanover next to Mink Brook. In 40 years of living there, none of the damage to our property has been from brook flooding. However, we've had lots of damage to our road and property that appears to be caused by the runoff from two developments across the road. So instead of naturally draining through the woods, all that water goes around the developments and ends up flooding our road. And then Anne says, your current guest says he's not a fan of green infrastructure. What about planning for less development in general, i.e. more open space? Now, you're in Manchester, so I understand it's a little bit different. I wonder, though, if there were more green pockets in Manchester or if the areas around Manchester had more trees and bushes and grass and so forth, if the flooding would be less dramatic. I just wonder what you think about that, Fred.
No, I agree, and I agree with both those Facebook comments. But the fact is that horse left the barn. This development has happened. Most future developments, communities have been very aggressive in forthcoming in addressing runoff issues and get green open space. And, you know, with the Hanover situation, I assume that went through a planning board process and everything, and that's really the proper channels to address that. And I agree, future planning should incorporate green infrastructure, should incorporate open space. You know, if our forefathers looked at that 50 years ago or 100 years ago, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in.
Okay. Fred, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Laura.
That's Fred McNeil, chief engineer at the Environmental Protection Division in Manchester, where he focuses on wastewater. Once again, the National Weather Service in Gray, Maine, has issued a flash flood watch for portions of Maine and New Hampshire. Here are the counties that they're talking about in New Hampshire: Belknap, Cheshire, Eastern Hillsborough, Interior Rockingham, Merrimack, Northern Carroll, Southern Grafton, Stratford, Sullivan, and Western and Central Hillsborough. Again, that flash flood watch from the National Weather Service is from noon today through Thursday morning. So as we talk about heavy rains in other parts of the country and how well prepared New Hampshire is, there's some information for us here in the Granite State. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. We're also on Instagram at NHPR Exchange, so check it out for some fun behind-the-scenes photos. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.